Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to this new series. We are going to be exploring 25 different talking points, which we're going to include, inshallah, things like the theories of justice, which is what we're going to be talking about today in epistemology, things like moral philosophy, things like political philosophy, things like the philosophy of religion, all of which are intended to arm Muslim people in the East and in the West in being able to deal with questions, contentions, and controversies relating to Islam and other world religions and ideologies. This series, if you like, is based on a poem which has been crafted by a sheikh, Sheikh Ali Al-Qudaymi, who we've had discussions with, and who has, with great generosity, been able to create for us a poem based on some of the most important talking points, as I've mentioned, on the issues that we've just talked about. So what we're going to be doing, inshallah ta'ala, is we are going to be reading the poem in the Arabic language, as per kind of the tradition of the traditionalist schools of Islamic thought, and then translating this, and then going into the objectives of the lesson, and talking about today, it will be epistemology. So, inshallah, without further ado, I'm going to give it to you, inshallah, Abdul Rahman, so you can read the poem.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Faslu masadir al-ma'rifa. Masadir al-ma'rifa al-muqarrah. Al-aqlu wal-his kadhaka al-fitra. Faslu ta'rif al-haq. Wal-haqqu fihi ikhtalafa al-falasifa. Wa kullu firqatin lidhaka wasifa. Fa-asbahu thalathata al-madaris. Wa kulluhum lima yaqulu daris. Awaluha madrasatu al-tatabuqi. لواقع أكرم بها ووافق وذا عليه المسلمون الجمهرة العلماء العقلاء البررة أما التي مرجعها التناسب حتى لو الواقع عنها غائب فالحق فيها لم يناقب نفسه وهكذا بنوا لذاك أسه ثالثها مدرسة البراغمة وهي لحق بانتفاع مثبتة.
Right. So for those Arabic speakers that want to know what we're talking about and want a kind of exposition of these things, we will be doing this series also in the Arabic language, which will be on the Sapiens Arabic YouTube page. To get straight to the objectives of today's session, inshallah, are as follows. To know what constitutes knowledge and how it's differentiated from other types of so-called cognitive successes. And we'll get to these key words. What is a cognitive success? Why do epistemologists use this term? How is it differentiated from knowledge? What is knowledge? And so on. These are very important questions that any student of philosophy or epistemology should know the answers to. So we're going to be looking both at the Islamic intellectual history, or having discussions based on some of the words of some of the great scholars from that history, and the Western academic history on this topic. The second thing is to be able to familiarize ourselves with the debates in epistemology regarding theories of truth. Now, there's lots of debates in epistemology, but this is perhaps one of the most foundational ones. What is truth? Because we have conversations all the time of this is the truth and this is not the truth. We have these conversations mundanely in the parlance that we have in everyday vernacular with, you know, maybe your spouse, your friend and so on. This is the truth and this is not the truth. All the way up to the most metaphysically complicated topics. We talk about this is the ultimate truth and this is the absolute truth. But it would suggest, it would beg the question actually, more foundationally, what is truth in the first place? And is there any consensus on what truth is? Today we have to know what the competing schools of thought in epistemology consider as truth. And we have to know the arguments they use for and against other schools of thought. We'll be focusing on three particular schools of thought which have probably the most prominence in the Western Academy, which are the coherentist theory of truth, the pragmatist theory of truth, and of course, the correspondence theory of truth as well. So that's the second objective. The third objective is to be able to make a judgment about this debate. So we have to be engaging critically with these topics, not just mundanely or passively. We have to be able to kind of put ourselves in the shoes, proverbial shoes of the pragmatist, of the coherentist, and or the correspondence theorist. And so we'll start right now with this fundamental question. What is knowledge? So epistemologists, they differentiate between belief and knowledge. This is extremely important because belief is something which can be true or it can be something which is false. You have true belief and false belief. So what is knowledge then? Knowledge is justified true belief. Can you say that one more time? Yes, I have no problem in repeating this. Knowledge is, according to the majority definition in epistemology, is justified true belief. In other words, three criterion need to be met in order for something to be considered as knowledge. That has to be justified, it has to be true, and it has to be a belief. Now, these three things have to be in place in order for the thing to be knowledge. Can you say there's such a thing as true knowledge and false knowledge? On this strict epistemological definition, no, you can't. There's either knowledge or there isn't knowledge. If you say something which is false, this is not knowledge. And just on a side note, it's really interesting. I was thinking about this verse in the Quran, since we're Muslims and coming from that perspective. There's an ayah in Surah Al-Kahf. مَا لَهُمْ بِهِ مِنْ عِلْمٍ وَلَا لِأَبَائِهِمْ. That what kind, they have no knowledge of this, when Christians are saying that, you know, Jesus is the Son of God, you know, that they have no knowledge of this. So it's as if their false beliefs amount to nothing, basically. It's not even knowledge. It's not false knowledge, it's not knowledge at all. مَا لَهُمْ بِهِ مِنْ عِلْمٍ. They have no knowledge of it. Such knowledge does not even exist in the first place, because this is a false belief. Interesting, anyway, but going back to this point, that this is what knowledge is. However, someone came out called Gettier, a very interesting character came out, and he proposed what we refer to as Gettier examples, actually. And these are, you know, examples, theories and so on, of where all these three conditions can be met, but actually knowledge is not achieved. And I'll give you one example of such a thing. He wrote this in two pages. I mean, you can see, sometimes you can write something in an academic way, and it's very short and brief, but it has such an impact. I think 1.5 pages or 2 pages. And these were referred to as Gettier examples, in fact. But I'll give you an example, because his example is a bit long-winded. I'll give you an example of what would constitute as a Gettier example. For example, if you look at a clock, okay, and it says 12 o'clock on it. It says 12 o'clock, but there's no battery in that clock. There's no battery in that clock. Do you have a justified belief? Yes, you have a justified reason for thinking it's 2 o'clock or 12 o'clock, whatever it is. What if it happens to be 12 o'clock? Yes, you have a justified true belief. But it's based on something which is telling you the wrong time. And it's just coincidental that at this point in time, you're looking at the clock. And so sometimes you can have instances where all three criterion, justified true belief, are not met, but then you can still have you can still have knowledge, or you can have false knowledge, and so these were dubbed Gettier examples. But for the most part, apart from Gettier, most people would still insist actually on this usage of the term knowledge, which is that it's justified true belief. Now, in epistemology, there are different schools of thought. If you read a book, something like Evidence and Inquiry, written by Susan Hack, where she discusses the, you know, different schools of thought and so on. Different, you know, schools of thought. Now, I want to be very clear. We're going to be talking about theories of truth today. Okay. In theories of truth, there are three main schools of thought. But in epistemology, generally, there are more than three that are discussed. And sometimes when, for example, we talk about coherentism, or we're talking about whatever it is we're going to be talking about, one can get confused between the two categories. When we're talking about theories of truth, sometimes the same school of thought is described in a slightly different way. So, for example, one of the major schools of thought in epistemology is something called foundationalism. And foundationalism is the idea that actually there cannot be an infinite regress. And this is the main argument from foundationalism, actually. There cannot be an infinite regress of explained things. There have to be these basic ideas that the superstructure of other ideas are supported upon. If you like, they can be called axioms. They can be called axioms. So these things that they don't have an explanation of their own, they break the infinite regress and they explain other beliefs. Okay, they don't have an explanation of their own and they explain other beliefs. So foundationalism is this idea that epistemologically there must be a foundation for our beliefs, and then the superstructure of other beliefs are rested on this foundation. On the other hand, you have a school of thought like coherentism, which describes beliefs less like a building and more like a web. In fact, they say there's not an epistemological advantage in so-called basic beliefs over other beliefs. And they would say that actually these two kinds of beliefs are the same in epistemic weight. And we'll talk about how this relates to today's discussion. But these schools of thought are really important because they have their kind of inception. The rationalist school of thought, for example, has its inception in the Renaissance. So you have Descartes. As many of you would have known this name, Descartes, René Descartes, who wrote the Meditations, you know, he employed systematic doubt to come to a particular conclusion of I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum, which is the base. It was actually the base for a long time of Western philosophy, for the rationalist school in particular. So I think, therefore I am, is the most foundational thing you can come to. He wrote in his Meditations using systemic doubt, that, you know, I doubt my this, I doubt my senses, it could be a demon that's possessing me, it could be this, it could be that. At the end, he said, the one thing I can't doubt, he said, one thing I can't doubt is, I think, therefore I am. By the way, Nietzsche came back, you know, he wrote, I think it was in The Gay Science or Beyond Good and Evil, one of the books, and he said, actually, there's some presuppositions in this thing which you thought was unshakable, which the cogito ergo sum, or, you know, I think, therefore I am, says, well, you're saying I, which presupposes that you exist. When you say, I think, therefore I am, it says, why not? Avicenna, quite interestingly, Ibn Sina, he had a much more watertight version of the cogito many hundreds of years before René Descartes attempted the operation, which is, he said, and now, la shak, nahu wujud, there's no doubt that there is existence. So he didn't personalize it, and he didn't have a personal pronoun. And this was written in a book called Najat, that Ibn Sina wrote. But anyway, putting that to the side, the rationalist school of thought, they had this idea that you can rationalize almost any belief system in your mind. You can come to the truth with your mind. And those who went against them were the British empiricists, for example. John Locke was one of them. You had the empiricists who believed that the sense, well, experience or sense datum was the best way of achieving information. Like your five senses, this is how, actually, you get information. So there was a tension, if you like, between the empiricist school of thought and the rationalist school of thought. And of course, then the postmodernist school of thought, which we're going to touch upon maybe somewhere along the line of this series. But these are some of the epistemological schools of thought. You have skepticism, which is the idea that we can't even know anyway. We can't even know anyway. These are things that they doubt the idea that we can know these things. But then the question would be, I mean, is that a knowledge claim in and of itself? I mean, that we can't know anyway. But these are all different approaches to epistemology. You can be a skeptic, you can be a rationalist, you can be an empiricist, you can be a foundationalist. Yeah, you know, even Susan Hack in her book, she talks about foundherentism. She puts things together. Foundationalism and coherentism, she puts them together. You can play around with the categories in this way. And depending on how you start, this will determine how you end, if you like. You know, if you start as a skeptic, you might not end up anywhere. You might just say, well, I doubt this, I doubt that, I doubt this, I doubt that. It's very important for us to establish, okay, who we are talking to and what criterion they are putting in place for what is beneficial knowledge, what is true and justified belief. Because if the criterion is jumbled, then the conclusions will be jumbled. And so this is really an extremely important point, because the issue of evidence will keep coming up. But what counts as good evidence? Well, for the rationalist, it's rational evidence. For the empiricist, it's empirical evidence, you know, and so on and so forth. And for the coherentist, it's coherent evidence. Coherent set of propositions that come together in a manner that doesn't contradict itself, as we're going to come and see later on. So, in the Islamic tradition, obviously we have the fitra, which is another thing, and this was in the poem, because the three things that we're going to come to in the poem was al-hissu, which is the idea of the five senses, you know, the organs of perception. You want to put them that way, you know, the organs of perception, the five senses. And then you have al-aqlu, which is, it covers the rationalist school of thought, numbers, you know, rationalization, things which are not necessarily put under a microscope, but that you can still perceive. And then you have the fitra, which is intuitive knowledge, which many have spoken about, many have been skeptical about, but it's still something there. And what is intuitive knowledge? It's an instinct. In fact, that's what the kind of Muslim scholars have said, you know, aforetime, that it's an instinct. It's not something, it's supra-rational, if you like. It's not something which can be reduced to a set of propositions that can be put in propositional terms if P P entails Q, and, you know, then Q, then P. You can't put it in this language, you know. Instinctual knowledge or intuitive knowledge is this knowledge which just comes naturally. Ibn Taymiyyah himself, he says, it's just like a baby instinctively knowing how to suckle the breast of the mother. It's that instinctive. You don't even need to think about it. It just happens. It's like touching a candle and knowing that it's hot. That kind of knowledge is instinct. It's pure, unadulterated instinct. And it's really interesting, because I do want to mention something here. First of all, it's very important. The fitrah, this is the understanding of Ibn Taymiyyah. And yes, Al-Ghazali had a very similar understanding. And that's why the Muslim world today, I mean, they're settled on this idea that the fitrah really is its innate predisposition to believing in God. But this was not the only kind of classical idea of what the fitrah was, by the way. The Mu'tazilis, yes, they believed in that. But someone like Ibn Abdul Barr, he believed that the fitrah was neutral. He didn't believe that the fitrah was pushing you towards believing in God or not. In fact, he, you know, فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا, he believed that, you know, it could give you a propensity to good or evil. Avicenna, Ibn Sina, he didn't believe that either. He believed that it was just something that which allowed you to see the intelligibles in the world. It's not something which is, you know, and so there was some slight level of controversy what the fitrah entailed. But the fitrah, from the Islamic perspective, is the idea, okay, that you are born with this receptivity, if you want to put it in modern language, receptivity to believing in God, this agent. And this is something which cognitive science has affirmed to a large extent. So Justin Barrett, a cognitive scientist, I'm just going to read something that he says, quite interesting, and I'll send it to you if you don't have. But in page 158 of his book, he says, even a 13-month-old appears to regard an internal agent, one that does not resemble a human or animal, as capable of bringing about order, whereas a similar non-agent is not capable. Babies look longer, as if surprised when rolling a ball appears to neatly stack a heap of blocks, compared with when a ball turns the neat stack into a jumble. When the ball has eyes and a mouth on its scoots towards the blocks like an agent instead of rolling, then babies do not regard the two events differently. Meaning, even a child can assess causation and attach teleos to it, purpose and so on. We have this not just receptivity to believing in God, as he says, but actually we also have this receptivity to make purpose into the world. And these are things that potentially the fitrah can include, you know. But definitely we have an intuitive kind of sense for this. Cognitive science pushes in that direction. And so he mentions that. So just to kind of summarize on this point before we move on to the theories of truth, which is what we're going to be talking about today, it's important for us to know what we think, what are the definitions here? What are the definitions of knowledge? What are the definitions of belief? How is knowledge differentiated from belief in the epistemological works? What is intuitive knowledge? How is it different from rationalist knowledge? What types of, what schools of thought are there? We have to settle on this. You know, we have to know this before we move on, because if we don't know this, we can't move on. So, brother, tell us, what are some of the schools of thought? What are some of the schools of thought in epistemology?
So, from what we mentioned, we obviously have the rationalists, which you mentioned.
Yes.
A group of philosophers. So this is a debate that happened in the Enlightenment period. You mentioned the rationalists and the empiricists. The rationalists who believe that you could understand, kind of, you could get to truth in a sense just through rational methods. Empiricists came along and said that, you know, sort of sensory experience is required. You need to, you know, have experience of the world, that type of thing. And you have the skeptics, skepticism. They're basically just skeptics. You know, they say can't really know anything, and that's potentially countered by, you know, is that a truth claiming of itself? How do you know that? So those would be three.
Excellent. Is there anything else we mentioned today? Does anyone else remember any other schools of thought that we mentioned generally in epistemology? By the way, this is by no means an exhaustive list, but these are some of the main ones Any other schools of thought that we mentioned today in epistemology that anyone remembers?
We talked about foundationalism, right?
Yes.
This is basically the idea that we start off with axioms that can't be proven, that are basically self-evident.
Yes.
And then we have to build a worldview based on those axioms. And those axioms cannot be proven in any way. We just have to accept it as it is.
Beautiful. Foundationalism is a very important one because it is probably the most popular one. I'm just guessing here, but the idea of a structure and a superstructure, or the idea of foundations of the house and then the rest of the house. This is how they put it. Who differs with them in terms of who we talked about, and they don't like this analogy and they have something else to say about it?
Coherence.
Yes. What do they say?
They have the web-like framework.
Yes.
Whereby they dismiss the idea of basic beliefs having more epistemological advantage over complex.
That's perfectly well put. You know, they believe it's a web. Coherence is to say it's a web of beliefs. And so there's no advantage. It's exactly right. There's no advantage over one set of beliefs over others. And so they would completely deny, you know, this. We're going to move on to theories of truth now, guys, since we have covered this kind of preamble, if you like. But before we do so, are there any questions? Yes.
The basic argument itself, one could argue, is a truth claim, right? The idea that we can't give more epistemic weight to one set of ideas over another, that itself is a truth claim, right? So wouldn't that require a presupposed...
So the Coherence School of Thought, their criterion for truth, as we're going to come to right now, is consistency. Okay, so... We're going to see how, and it's a good way to segue actually, we're going to see how they make this kind of argument and why they make the argument and what things have been said. I mean, even Bertrand Russell has some very interesting things to say about the coherentists. And what we're going to be doing after as well is just getting involved in, okay, let's pretend to be coherentists for a second. Let's pretend to be, you know, correspondence theorists, and then let's really flesh this out. So in terms of the theories of truth, there are three major schools of thought. Okay, three major schools of thought. There are others, but these are the three major ones, okay? The three major ones are correspondence theorists. Okay, number one, correspondence theorists. Now, correspondence theorists, they would say a belief is only true if and only if it corresponds with something in existence. A belief is only true if and only if it corresponds with something in existence. So, for example, if I say I am wearing a ring, or I'm holding a ring. Okay, this is, so I am effectively saying that there exists a ring in the external world, in objective reality, and I am holding it. Seems extremely straightforward, doesn't it? And this is really the prevailing school of thought, and for good reason, because this, without this, what can you say? What kind of truth claims can even be made? If you can't say, well, truth is that which corresponds with reality, then how can we be intelligible at all talking about the external world? How can there be intelligibility when speaking about the external world? So this is the poem states, this is what the Muslims are upon, because if they were on the other two theories, as we say, this would give rise to the possibilities that, you know, you can have truths which are mythological. We're going to come to this in a second. But this is impossible in the Islamic framework. Okay, this is impossible because when, for example, the Quranic message is disseminated, we're talking about things that exist in the real world. When God speaks about, you know, the stories of the prophets and messengers and so on, he's not talking about some video game or some figment of someone's imagination, some mythology. We're talking about history. We're talking about some things that happen in the real world, in the objective world. We are not talking about some things which are in a figment of someone's imagination. Okay, so this, I would argue, you cannot really be a Muslim, okay, without having this kind of view of truth. When we say God exists, we don't say he exists in my mind. We don't mean this. We mean God exists in the in external existence, at least. I'm going to say world here, but external existence. That there is a God, and that is a truth about the externality of existence. That's not something which we are inventing or something, which we are imagining or which we can invent even. It's not susceptible to us being able to invent it, right? So anyway, this is, the poem states that this is the position that we must take, in fact, as Muslims. But the correspondence theory of truth has been under attack, and this is something which we need to be pay attention to. That's the first theory of three major ones. The second one is the coherentist theory of truth, which we've described. And the coherentist theory of truth says a belief is true if it coheres with a body of statements that we take to be true. Really, it's true if it's consistent. Okay. Now, we, once again, as Muslims, we don't deny the fact that something has to be consistent in order to be true. But is this a necessary or sufficient condition? So we would say it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. A correspondence theorist would argue that consistency is a necessary but not sufficient condition to truth. Yeah, you can't have two contradictory propositions. But something is consistent. It can be consistent in your hallucination. Something, you know, playing games with my son or something, you know, and they are thinking, you know, these coherentists would probably think this is as true as the real world. Because the game is actually very consistent. It has levels, it has, you know, what, stage one, stage two, stage three, and so on. So a computer game can be, on the coherentist theory of truth, it can be consistent, it can be true. Now, pragmatists, they say, and this is the third theory, so we said number one was? What's number one?
Correspondence.
Correspondence number two was? Coherentist. Number three is the pragmatists, okay? And they started off in America, of all places, the most pragmatic people in the world, except when they're invading other lands. But that's another story for another day. They say truth is whatever, actually, maybe they're most pragmatic then, actually. Unfortunately, not most successful for them. Truth is whatever is useful. This is what they say. No, the truth is whatever is useful. This is what John Dewey said. Truth is what works. Charles Peirce, truth is tentative. These people, William James and Charles Peirce and John Dewey, were really the three major founding fathers of the pragmatic school of thought in the early 1900s, 18 to 1900s, late 18 to 1900s, early 1900s. And this is what they were saying, that something, if it's true, if it works. And of course, you can probably imagine the contradictions and or some of the objections that you may already have to this. I mean, does anyone have any objections if someone says, well, what is true is what works? Well, what would you say to that? How do you know what works? But they'll say, well, we'll try it. They'll say, they have an answer to that. They'll say, we'll try it. So what else can someone say, you know, about that? So if you say, well, it's true if it works, how would you go about trying to refute that statement?
Propaganda works.
Yeah, propaganda works, it's true. But they'll say, in one aspect at least, it's true then. You know, they would actually, I mean, whatever works is true, at least in one perspective. That's their idea. If it works, it's true. Now, this proposition, if it works, it's true. What's problematic about it?
There's a lot of vagueness involved. How do you define what works or what's useful?
So they will say to that, how do we define what works and what's useful? We would try it out. And we would try it out in whatever subject, like for example, if we're talking about physics, we'd try out the theory. If we're talking about cars, we'll try out the car. If we're talking about marriages, we'll try out the woman or the man or whatever. Whatever it is, it's true if it works, and it's false and if it doesn't. If we're talking about politics, we'll see what creates more stability, if you like, you know, for the economy, for the society. If it works, then it's true. If it's not, then it. How would you refute that? They'll say, it works, yes. They wouldn't say it's circular. They would say, yeah, it's fine. The statement works for me. It works for us. It facilitates us. This idea to start our, you know, the enterprise of practical knowledge. You know, so yeah, it's itself practically useful. They would say the statement can be argued to be practically useful. Let's think a little bit deeper. What's the problem with this theory? Think about it. Think a bit deeper. Now, just take up.
Can't be experimentalized, would they say it's just useless knowledge then? For example, like even like the Big Bang Theory, they can't experimentalize, form it into an experiment, would they say it's useless?
No, it's not about making it into an experiment or not. It's just, it is about whether, well, if a theory is unfalsifiable, even from, like, you know, the Popperian idea, Karl Popper, whatever, if it cannot be kind of isolated and experimented, then it's not even scientific, according to Popper, right? So that's something we'll talk about, inshallah, when we talk about the kind of philosophy of science. But this point is a very important point. If someone says to you, because it's foundational, it's actually foundational. You go to somebody and say, what is the truth? For me, the truth is whatever works. Okay. As Machiavellian as it may sound, as consequentialist as it may sound, it is whatever works. I do whatever works, and if it works, I do it. It sounds very corporate, kind of corporate. So we'll get to that. It's good that you just keep thinking, no problem. If anything, anything comes up, just put your hands up and you can just at any time just bring it up. But we'll start with coherentist theory, okay? And coherentism has been refuted in so much as it can be fictitious, as we've kind of alluded to before. And so Bertrand Russell, he talks about Santa Claus. And let me tell you what he said. He said, I have always found that the hypothesis of Santa Claus works unsatisfactorily in the widest sense of the word. Therefore, Santa Claus exists is true, although Santa Claus does not exist. I find the belief that Caesar crossed the Rubicon very distasteful. So here, you know, in a sense, this is an objection, you could say, to pragmatism as well, but it works in similar vein to coherentism. There are lots of things which cohere, but which are fictitious. And you might say, well, that's not a problem for coherentists. We don't have a problem with that. We'll say that the issue comes at this point. If you have three different stories of the same thing, they are all equally internally coherent, but all three of them contradict with one another. Then we have a state of affairs where, according to their own criterion, that there's a contradiction that exists because of coherentism. Maybe not within this. So, for example, you have a story. Okay, if someone makes a story of Bob going to the mall, or I don't know what happens, and something happens to him, and then someone makes another story, which is fake story, it's a fictitious, it's a mythological story of Bob, same Bob, but it's a contradictory story, and a third person makes another story of Bob, and it's contradictory to story one and two, then you have contradiction, it's no longer coherent. But you have internal consistency, but external contradiction. The issue, therefore, is that with coherentism, since all that is requirement is, the requirement is only consistency, there can be a state of affairs where there are many truths, all of which contradict with one another, which would be against the criterion that is required for coherentism to work in the first place. And in regards to pragmatism, which is what we were just talking about, the useful, if it works, whatever, the strongest possible objection to this is that you can imagine a state of affairs where something is a useful falsehood. You can imagine a state of affairs where something is a useful falsehood and something is a useless truth. For example, and O'Hare mentions this actually, this example, when he's talking about evolutionary reliabilism, I think that was the topic he was talking about, which is actually a closely connected topic. If you go and if someone has the false belief that all berries are poisonous, someone has a false belief that all berries are poisonous, they go into the jungle, they go into the forest, sorry, I should say, and they just avoid all berries. They avoid what? All berries, right? They're not having any berries. The question is, this is a false belief, right? Because there are some berries which are harmful and some berries which are not harmful, right? It's a false belief that would make them avert the poisonous berries, correct? So it's a useful false belief. So it's conceivable that you can have a useful falsehood. And it's conceivable that you can have a useless truth. There are many things that you can know that will not benefit you in the least. So this is the major objection that you can put to the pragmatists. Say, well, if it's the case that truth is utility and usefulness, then why can we put forward examples of things which are useless and which are not true, or useful and useful and false. Useful and false in the case of the berries. So this is really, I would say, the best refutation that I've heard. This is the best refutation that I've heard. Now, what are the problems with correspondence theory? The problem is, it kind of relies on this kind of foundationalism, and it relies on this axiomatic rendering. Because then you could ask the question, we'll go back to our Berry example, and this is something maybe we'll put out there for you guys. We'll all talk about it in a second. But going back to the Berry example, we can ask the question, well, just because you're saying that you can have useless truths, useful falsehoods, useful falsehoods, yeah, it's still circular, because you are presupposing the correspondence theory of truth in order to come to that conclusion, which is that truth is correspondence. How can you respond to that? Well, someone will say it has to be axiomatic, or axiomatically understood, and going back to foundationalism, that there are some things, there's an external world, there's a mind-body dualism, or whatever it may be, and that we are operating on this paradigm, and there's truths out there that we can reach. Can you prove those presuppositions? No, you can't. They're axiomatic. So if you try and prove them, it will be circular. So then you go to the problem of infinite regress, and this is the problem that we have. But it's not a problem which is an undercutter. The problem with pragmatism and coherentism is actually an undercutter. The objections are undercutting, whereas the problem with correspondence theory is an evidentiary problem. It's the issue of how can you prove the axioms. You can't prove the axioms are by nature meant to be unprovable. So these are some of the issues. What we're going to do now is we are going to work in groups. How many of us are there? I don't know. We're going to find out how many of us we're going to count. We're going to do three groups. Okay, three groups of people. One group is going to be the coherentists, the other is going to be the correspondents, and the third one is going to be the pragmatists, and we are going to argue as if we are that group, and then we're going to switch over and do the same thing, and then switch over and do the same thing. Hopefully that will doesn't need to be filmed or anything like that. We'll switch off the camera from now. And for those at home, what I will say is this is the first lesson, and hopefully you have benefited from it. This is one of the most important lessons in many ways, because it's the lesson that sets the scene for everything else. In the next lesson, we are going to be going into some of the main themes, some of the that you'll find in Dawah, in engagements with Muslims and non-Muslims and so on. But this was the first lesson on epistemology. Inshallah, we'll see you next week. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.